Welcome to this STS video roundtable. My name is Dr. Juan Sanchez from Baltimore, Maryland. To my right is Dr. Michael Kent from Boston. To my left is Dr. Kevin Lubdell from Charlotte, North Carolina. And to my far left is Dr. Chance Connor from Austin, Texas. Today we're going to be discussing the discrepancy between evidence-based practices and real-world practices. We know that there is a gap, and we know that it takes, on average, 17 years before a new innovation gets disseminated into clinical practice. Dr. Lubdell, why do you think there's such a gap?
I know it'll sound trite, but I think that the reality is this is complicated. What we'll try to do to help the teams is think about individuals, whether it's the patient or the practitioner, and their values. We'll also think about teams and teamwork and some of the challenges there, as well as an organization and their values. I think when you take that group or think about this paradigm, you begin to understand the complexities. We'll talk everything from, again, individual values and decision making to things like incorporating evidence and best practices, and then even strategies that'll help the teams to implement those things reliably.
I would add, Juan, that there's a whole science on this issue called implementation science. It talks about why it is that best practices or evidence-based initiatives are not always practiced, and that can apply to nuclear power, to aviation safety, and obviously to clinical medicine. And I think it's important to understand that there is a chain that goes from the creation of knowledge, innovation, disruptive technology, to the dissemination of knowledge, to then the use of that knowledge by the end user. And I think in surgery, and specifically in thoracic surgery, we do a very good job of creation of knowledge. I think this meeting, our societies testify to that. I think dissemination of knowledge, also, we are very strong in this roundtable being only one example, but I think in a lot of studies, the chain is determined by the weakest link. And almost always that is a problem of the end user, the hospital, the clinician, actually implementing that best practice guideline.
Dr. Connor?
Well, so what are, but that is the biggest challenge, and I think that's why the gap exists, is the implementation by the individual end user. So what are some things that we can do to impact that so that we can start to move the bar towards accepting well-established evidence-based practices?
Right. So I can think of two examples that are very timely. One of them would be surgical checklists. The other one would be enhanced recovery protocols after surgery. We heard about the latter this morning, that there's a lot of data that enhanced recovery protocols improve patient satisfaction, reduce length of stay, and yet we know that they are not always being adopted. And if they are being adopted, there's a concern about sustainability. And there's literature on these issues, checklists and enhanced recovery protocols, and I'll share with you, you know, the summary of that. There are a few barriers that are consistent among both of these. One of them is you have to be flexible in adapting the protocol to your local context. So for example, if you have a checklist designed by a national society, it may not be relevant precisely to your practice. If you're a pediatric surgeon or a congenital surgeon, there has to be flexibility. If there's rigidity in the fidelity of the model, that will come at the cost of it being implemented. So I think you have to be flexible. The other factor, which is intuitive, is you need buy-in. You need leadership, and I think that this is an area where surgeons should take the lead, that you need a champion of a clinician to help bring this to clinical practice. So having executive leadership, buy-in is important, but if you don't have clinical leadership and clinical champions, it's not going to work.
I might add just to that a little bit because it might help. I think when you look at how ideas flow and become habits, there's this process whereby a individual or a team would explore, they get engaged, and then they have ideas and they make those things their habits. And ultimately, I think what we're looking at, for instance, in the enhanced recovery programs or just our daily work, is how do we have tacit knowledge and operational routines. That's what we're all aiming at, so that there's something that's predictable and highly reliable.
What other areas, other than the checklist and ERAS, do we feel that we have, there's a gap between what we know are best practices and the real world in cardiothoracic surgery?
Well, a good example is the extreme variability in blood transfusion after CABG, for example. I think in a lot of literature that range ranges from as low as 7% to as high as 90%. And with all the data that's been published on the safety and benefits of a restricted transfusion policy, how do we bring everyone closer to the mean and bring those outlying places back into, you know, what would be considered best practices? The database would be a very good example of how we can use that data. You can take Michigan's example and use of the MAMRI and what they did in terms of identifying individual performers and making them aware of it and educating them in a helpful way. And then they completely changed the use of MAMRI, for example, in the state of Michigan. I think we could do something similar with blood transfusions after CABG.
I did want to follow up on that. I think the key is collaborative efforts. So if you have a group of surgeons, all of whom I think by definition are dedicated to providing high quality care, provide them information in a non-punitive manner. I think that alone has shown to be of benefit. So I think those efforts that we heard about this morning that occur in Michigan and Maryland and Virginia absolutely show the power of how surgeons and clinicians, just by collaborating together and providing data in a non-punitive manner, can help improve practice adoption.
Yeah, I absolutely think the non-punitive approach and collaborative approach is definitely the way to do it.
I think we're fortunate, in cardiac and thoracic surgery too, to have this rich database with risk models. If you go to some of the work done by behavioral economists to augment what's known in standard traditional economics, you realize that much like what we're talking about, there's an individual involved. And what are the challenges to decision making, and how do we deal with competing values to ultimately get the answers that we want? So going back to the risk models, there's the real belief that quantification, as opposed to the heuristics or the mental shortcuts, are much more reliable and complex endeavors. So it does beg for us to create operational routines where we quantify risk as much as possible and then try to standardize our approach to things.
You know, Kevin, you talked about tacit knowledge and operational routine. What are some of the specifics of those team-to-team interactions that, you know, that lead to that?
Well, I think it kind of goes back to, as we've been talking about, the multidisciplinary team. I think you get together, you start to explore, people truly get engaged, they feel like they're a part of a team. Through that process, you start to set goals and incorporate new knowledge. You learn from that, get new ideas, and whatever those ideas are, they become your routines.
Right. I think the other area that, Juan, you're an expert in is the structure of these teams, and high-performing teams, teams that are willing to safely adopt new technology, are teams where every member has a role, where every member feels that it is their responsibility and right to be involved in promoting a culture of safety. And I think there's a lot of literature on that. I think teams that are organic, as opposed to rigidly hierarchical, not only provide better care for patients, but adopt innovation and technology more readily. And I think, you know, it's important to acknowledge what type of team we lead. We are the leaders of these teams in many situations, and I think the style of that team comes from our leadership style.
We have meetings such as this. We have clinical guidelines, expert consensus on a few things. What other interventions should we be thinking about to help the practicing surgeon really apply the knowledge and innovation that we develop as an organization?
Well, one of the things that we've talked about are peer-to-peer audits, both, you know, going to an underperforming or an outlying performing facility or a reverse peer-to-peer audit where we give the opportunity for those facilities to then reach out to experts and seek their input on how do they change their culture and change their team so their performance improves.
I think part of that is to be careful not to use the labels of underperforming and overperforming. I think the culture that we want to establish and we believe in is we are always getting better. If I'm a three-star institution in my practice, that doesn't mean I don't have the right and the desire to improve. So I think it's not that we want to establish a punitive mechanism whereby an underperformer can learn from an overperformer, but to have a society, which I think we have, where we are open to learning, where we can go to other institutions to always get better. I think that is very important.
I would reinforce that. I think that the Society of Thoracic Surgeons, a part of their strategic plan is to be a learning organization, promote institutional learning, and at the same time facilitate the continuous improvement efforts that I think are mm-hmm. part of all of our DNA.
I agree.
Well, gentlemen, we're out of time. Thank you. This has been an STS Video Roundtable.